Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. I'm your host, Maya Fisher-French, and this week I have been immersed in the national budget, which was announced by the finance minister on Wednesday, the 21st of February. In this podcast, I really want to help listeners understand the budget and also what goes into making the decisions around how our money is spent. So I will be joined later by Dr. Edgar Sishi, who is the head of the budget office in National Treasury. So we're going right to the source. But before I welcome Mr. Sishi, I would like to give like a 2-minute quick overview of the budget. Over the next financial year, so this means from the 1st of March 2024 to the 20th of February 2025, the government plans on spending 2.37 trillion rand. Now, we throw out this word trillion, but what does it really mean? So let me just put it in context. If you received 1 rand every single second 1 rand dropped into your bank account, it would take you 31,688 years to reach 1 trillion rand. That is a big number. And of this 2.3 odd trillion rand, 1.4 trillion rand is going to what government describes as the social wage. These are social services like health, education, and social grants. And the other really big expense for government is what they will be spending on servicing debt costs. And that is about 382 billion rand, not trillion, billion rand. It's important to understand that we're not talking about repaying debt like you and I pay off when we pay off a personal loan or a home loan. This is just the interest on that loan as the capital is rolled over. So we are now spending more on interest than we are spending on either health or education. Now, where does the government get the money to pay for all of this? So the government expects to collect just over 2 trillion rand in taxes. So that's from you and me. And in this budget, they announced an additional 15 billion rand of personal income taxes, which they're going to recoup via something called fiscal drag, which we're definitely going to explain later on in this podcast. So you may have realized now that the government is planning on spending 2.37 trillion, but they're only collecting about 2 trillion rand. So the difference is what we call a budget deficit. And that means government has to go out and borrow to make the difference. So on that note and on that summary, I now want to welcome Mr. Edgar Sishi, whose official title, by the way, is Deputy Director General at National Treasury. So welcome, Mr. Sishi, but I want to start off with the job title, Head of Budget Office. Sounds very, very important. So what does your job actually entail?
Well, hi, thanks for having me on. It entails essentially running the budget process. So I'm responsible for making sure that essentially all the documents that you see on budget day are put together. Fundamentally, you know, my team and I look after fiscal policy, which are sort of the core balancing decisions between the spending revenue and debt. So the balance of all of those different elements of the things that you were talking about in your intro are on my lap, as well as advising on expenditure planning and the wage bill, and finally on the International Development Cooperation. So where, international organizations or countries want to either donate money to South Africa or support us in some way, we coordinate that as well through my office.
Okay, so you're a really, really, really busy person, and you are an extremely, actually incredibly important. Basically, how our money gets spent is in your hands, and it's important money, this money of ours. We're going to talk a little bit later about taxes and that. But I want to ask you this, the pressure that you're under. I receive, several weeks before the budget's announced, I get tons of press releases as a journalist from economists, from various organizations, and they all have completely different opinions about how to run the national budget. And I sometimes feel it's a little bit like the couch referees in a rugby match. You know, they're probably grateful they don't actually have to do it, but they've got an opinion on it. So some say cut taxes to boost economic growth. Others say tax the rich, give more to the poor. And then you have others who say, don't worry about the debt problem, borrow more. So how do you at National Treasury sit down and create the framework for the national budget? How do you decide what the right choices are when you have all of these opposing opinions?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that in all of those opinions, there's an element of truth in each of them. So it's not a case of everybody is wrong all of the time or everybody's right all of the time or anything along those lines. It's that it's how we balance these things out against the data. So we have what we consider in any case a very data-driven approach to that. But it is also true that overlaying the data, you have to have a set of objectives, a set of goals that you have for where the fiscal position needs to go. And they need to be the kind of goals that are over the long term. So you need to be able to say, over the next 3 years, this is where we should be. And that's what we've been doing in respect of, for example, the debt situation of the country. And also, quite frankly, you have to have some humility. It's a natural part of a democratic or free society to have many voices, and you've got to listen to all of the different voices. But ultimately, the government has a responsibility, and we have a responsibility as a treasury to make sure that the budget contributes to the country in the long term rather than hurts the country in the long term. And that's a key point: is that among all of these views and all of these ideas, you can pick out elements of things that at a particular point in time can be helpful and other things that at a particular point in time can be hurtful to the economy. And the job of the Treasury is to make sure that we present a budget that does as much of the former than of the latter as possible. And frankly, at the same time, we also have to recognize on the theme of humility that government doesn't have money and that it only spends the money that it extracts from the economy. And so if the economy is growing, the scope for what government can do also grows. If the economy is not growing, then the same is true. And I think, we have an approach that says you have to have humility in respect of what you can and cannot do. And that recognition also means that you have to have a well-executed set of programs. And when they don't get well-executed and they don't work, you've got to take action, even if people in some cases don't like that action. And of course, finally, you have to have a robust budget preparation process. And what that means is that when people go into the process, there's clear rules, clear guidelines, and clear timelines.
And I think that is actually so what has come across so clearly to me over the years of covering the budget is exactly that. It's like having a medium-term budget. I hate it when they call it a mini budget. It's actually not. It's the opposite. It's the bigger budget. It's the three-year budget. And knowing where we're going to be in 3 years' time, I think most households could probably learn from that. If your child is starting grade 8, you're going to probably want to pay for tertiary education in 5 years' time. Start planning for it now, right? So it's kind of a lot of that is the future planning. But you mentioned the debt bill. And that came up very strongly and has come up in the last few years in the budget speech. It's now clocking in at 5.4 trillion rand. I think I did some maths. I think that's about, we're all about on the hook for about 86,000 rand each as individuals, if we had to divide that. That makes up 74% of GDP, I think. Am I correct at the moment? How does this compare to other countries at our level of development? And how is National Treasury planning on tackling this growing debt bill?
Yeah, so it is South Africa's debt as a percentage of the economy, as a percentage of GDP, is higher than the average for emerging markets. We've illustrated this in a couple of budget documents. We show the graphs and so forth. And in addition to that, and more important than that, the actual servicing of that debt is higher than for a lot of other countries, peer countries around the world. And it's a problem because the money You know, when you have that level of debt, the money that you're spending on interest on that debt crowds out spending on critical government services. It also means that, you know, the economy won't grow as much, because when the government borrows so much, that interest on its debt is higher than economic growth, which in South Africa it is. That means that it is more profitable for investors to put their money in government bonds rather than in real economic investments. And as the government issues more and more of these bonds to fund its deficits, the people who buy these bonds will demand a higher premium to compensate them for the risk of lending to South Africa. And so it becomes a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. The more you borrow, the more the interest on the debt goes up. The more the interest on the debt goes up, the more people are incentivized to put their money there rather than in building a factory or building a bridge or whatever. And as a result, it just spins on itself and it steals money away from economic activity and real investments in the economy. It also means that the economy then begins to not be able to service the debt because economic growth falls below the interest. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing about that is, that's why we announced in this budget yesterday, the minister announced in the budget yesterday, that we are targeting to stabilize debt in 2025-26. In other words, to stop it from growing and then afterwards to make it go down. And the way we do that is by tabling a primary fiscal surplus, which we plan to achieve at the end of next month. Because what that means is that non-interest expenditure will fall below revenue for the first time since 2008. So it's a significant achievement, because if we can do that, it means that we can rein in the debt, stop it from growing in the following year, and at the same time, stop the debt service costs from growing, and then start bringing them down over the rest of the decade.
And I think that's a really important point. And I think when I was listening to you talking about how, you know, interest becomes more and more expensive for you as you take on more debt, I was thinking, I'm sure many people listening to this understand it. When you borrow and borrow and borrow and your credit score deteriorates, so banks want to charge you more to borrow more. And it's effectively, that's the same thing that is happening. And that is why I'm afraid to say that government bonds are great investments. You're getting fantastic interest from them. A lot of people are using that opportunity at the moment. But whilst it's great for those people looking for interest-bearing investments, and I think you've highlighted so well, it is really not great for economic growth. We want people to be putting money into factories and into infrastructure, not into debt, to get that better interest rate. And I think a really important point there. But I want to now also move on to tax. Because when we're waiting for the national budget, everyone wants to know what the tax is going to be. Because I think tax affects us the most. Okay. I was just thinking about this today. I thought, you know, you go and you get a new job and they say you're going to get this really great salary, and then the money hits your bank account and it's so much less than you thought it was going to be, because there's this big deduction called PAYE. And then you go and you take what's left of your salary and you go shopping, and everything costs 15% more because of value added tax or VAT. Then you go fill up your car with fuel. You pay 6 rand per liter of tax. By the way, on a 50-liter tank of petrol, you're paying about 300 rand in tax on that. Mm-hmm. And then you're feeling so miserable that you go to the bottle store, buy yourself a bottle of whiskey, and add another 88 rand to the fiscus, which I actually was quite a surprise to me. That kind of explains to me the price of whiskey. So ultimately, most of the tax collected comes from individuals, either from salaries or their spending. So what is National Treasury's position on the current tax levels in South Africa? I get a sense there's this feeling that we've reached the maximum we can tax individuals. But then where do you find more money? Should we be looking at things like wealth tax?
Well, it's difficult to say, you know, whether you've reached the maximum or not. You know what the thresholds and are, it's difficult to, you know, sort of come up with a scientific way of deciding that. But I guess it's more, instead of limits or thresholds, we think of it in terms of the tolerance of the economy. In other words, at what point does the tax start taking more from the economy to such an extent, for example, that you disincentivize work because you're taxing people's income so much that, you know, it's not as worthwhile as it otherwise could be. So those are the balancing things. And by the way, those things can change from one period to another. And a big part of it, of course, is economic growth. Of course, it's also true that some items of government expenditure can add to the economy and therefore add to the tax base and through that produce a benefit for the fiscus. So the key is making the right choices around that. Now, on the taxes that you're talking about, you're right. Personal income tax is the biggest portion, followed by value added tax, which of course is a tax on consumption as people spend at the shop. 15% of what you buy, if it's not zero rated, is coming into the tax pool. And, you know, if we look at our tax levels, you know, we have a very robust and relatively good level of taxation. And by that, what I mean is that tax to GDP in South Africa is around about 25%, which is quite good for an emerging market economy. There's countries where the tax levels are lower than that. And look, we try and avoid raising taxes because we understand what you just said now, which is that, you know, the tax burden needs to be maintained at a reasonable level. And you don't want to put people in a position where it's too much. But also on the expenditure side, we, especially over the last, since the period after the global financial crisis, if people feel like government is not spending their money well, they tend to be less amenable to paying the tax. And to the extent that there have been many instances of waste, many instances of corruption in certain areas, you know, in the previous decade, that has a significant impact on how people feel about paying tax. And you've got to watch that as well. And that's what we are constantly doing also from our side.
That is such an interesting point. And I remember interviewing at the time when Minister Pravin Gordhan was the commissioner, SARS commissioner. And there was such a sense of goodwill. And they saw such a massive increase in the number of registered taxpayers and compliance. And there was this real sense of, okay, we're part of the solution. We're going to put money in. We're going to build this economy. We're going to build this country. And that made his job a lot easier. I think right now it's more challenging because people feel almost justified to some extent. And I'm not saying it's justified. I'm saying it's how people feel when they're not paying tax because they just feel it's being wasted. So I think that is a big challenge. And when you're looking at all of these taxes, and I know I want to talk about the fiscal drag because that was a mean little thing you threw in there, which people don't necessarily understand. But you could, I mean, there are things we've every year, there's this conversation about a wealth tax on one hand, and then you've got the other of increasing VAT, which is almost the opposite of a wealth tax because it taxes everybody and it can affect the poor. How do you look at all of these types of taxes? Are some just not worth it because you're not going to collect enough money from it versus the admin? How do you look at it?
Yeah. So, I mean, on wealth taxes, there has been conversations, obviously, about wealth tax, and I'm not talking specifically just in the Treasury, but in the general, you know, in the public space. You have to be careful with all taxes you have to assess what the unintended consequences could be, including on income. But with respect to wealth taxes, first of all, it's important to point out South Africa already has some wealth taxes, or at least I would say taxes that can be described as wealth taxes. We already have them. We have a capital gains tax, although some people think of it differently. My own view is that is a wealth tax because it is a tax on returns on, you know, asset valuation improvements when that asset gets disposed. So we've got that. One could argue that the property taxes are wealth taxes that municipalities levy. So we already have some form of taxes on property, on wealth, on, you know, accumulation, valuation, improvements, etc., on assets.
Estate duty is a
wealth tax that we have on the book. So I guess the question is, should we have more? The way I see it is, it's not about whether or not the, is it, should we have more, and if we do, will it raise the money? No point in levying a tax and then you don't get the money. And in order to decide that, you have to have data. You got to have information. How much wealth is out there? In what form does it take? How liquid is it? How easily disposable? How easily movable is it across borders and so forth? So you've got to have data on, you know, wealthy individuals, their asset holdings and so forth. And a couple of years ago in Parliament, we said that we're working with SARS to collect that data. And so that process has been underway. It's not an easy process. And I think we're getting close to getting data that tells us where we are and therefore makes us understand what is the potential of an extended wealth tax, whether it's worth it or not worth it. And that's what will determine. With respect to fiscal drag, yes, one of the things that we did in this budget is that we didn't provide what we call a bracket creep relief, which is another way of describing the fiscal drag. And what basically that means is that because of inflation, year on year, people can move from one tax bracket to a higher tax bracket kind of automatically without, you know, doing anything. You can go to a higher tax bracket because of the inflationary impact that has on your wages. It just moves you up. And so a lot of times we give fiscal drag relief or bracket creep relief. In other words, we allow people to basically offset that inflation-driven increase, and therefore it provides relief. This year, we've not provided that relief. And the reason for that is that it's part of the overall fiscal consolidation. And by that, we mean the need to be able to stabilize the fiscal framework so that our debt levels can go down. And we're doing that both by getting extra revenue and by reducing spending. And both of those things in combination are helping us reduce the deficit and therefore the debt. So we didn't announce a tax increase as such. We just didn't provide the relief that in other years we would have provided, and that automatically raises more revenue for the fiscus.
Just for anyone listening, I ran some numbers which I did put into print. But you know, if you were earning sort of 350,000 a year, and you got a 6% salary increase, that would move you up into another tax bracket. It would move you to 371,000. So I think that person, individual, would now pay about 450 Rand more a month in tax, even though the increase was purely inflation. So their goods and services have gone up by the same amount. So there is definitely going to be some pain from that. And it did raise an additional 16.2 billion rand for National Treasury or for the fiscus through that. So I think it is important that people understand that, because I think I get a little bit annoyed with the headlines. Oh, relief for taxpayers, no increases in tax. No, there was. Literally, we paid 16.2 billion rand in tax. So there wasn't tax.
No, that is the reality. That's true. That, in fact, that is the case. And let me just say, you know, we don't enjoy doing it. It was not something that we preferred. And I can tell you right now, there were very, very long discussions and debates about it from last year already. It's not something we decided in the last few days or weeks. Mm. Last year, we were discussing it. But, you know, we feel that in the long run, it's the right thing to do, because we need the additional revenue and to couple it with the expenditure side, so that in the middle, that deficit can go down, and then we could have a healthier debt outlook that gives us the opportunity to have lower interest on debt. And that means that we don't have to do as much fiscal adjustment, either on the revenue side, on the expenditure side, in the future as what we're doing now. And so we're preserving essentially, you know, we're trying to assure intergenerational fairness. The reality is that the previous generation borrowed a lot of money, and the next generation shouldn't have to pay for the borrowing of the current generation. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why we're doing this.
Well, that's actually a good way of putting it. But I suppose also, National Treasury has to, and I think this is very important, this primary budget surplus is to say we will use this money to reduce debt, not to take on more spending. And I think that's part of the social
That's what.
contract that's being undertaken here.
Exactly,
Yeah.
that's right.
And I want to move on to the spending side, because there's something very interesting for me is the social wage. And there's this narrative out there that National Treasury is running an austerity budget. But National Treasury argues that this is actually a people's budget, because six out of every 10 rand collected in taxes is spent on social services. So if you think about that, it's 1.4 trillion rand, and it's mostly targeting the sort of 16 million households that are considered working class or poor. Most of them are benefit. How does this compare to other countries in the world?
I think it compares very well. Look, it's not common to spend 60% of the whole budget on the social wage. Not as common as people think. We've provided figures in this regard in previous budgets. The amount of money that we spend as a percentage of GDP on social grants, for example, is one of the highest of any developing country in the world. We are actually usually number one or number two. So we put a graph in, and you can see it if you look at the MTBPS in November that we tabled, as well as I think a previous budget, we showed how much we're spending on social grants as a percentage of GDP. And over the last a couple of years, we've been either number one or number two. The data that we published in November had us at number one in terms of a spending on social service, particularly on social protection broadly. The amount of money that we spend on school nutrition, that we spend on the support to students, the amount of money that we spend on social grants is unusually high for a developing country. Usually, I would say number one or number two.
I suppose the question is, are we getting bang for our buck? That's maybe a separate question, and unfortunately outside the ambit of National Treasury, although you are trying to get departments to be more accountable. But I think maybe that is always comes back. Are we getting bang for our buck? And talking about the social grants, there was a continuation of the Social Relief Distress Grant, or the SDR grant. That came every year. It's like, well, we don't have the money for it, right? And now it's in the budget for the next 3 years. So it's been a contingency made for it. Where's the money going to come from if you're not going to increase taxes?
Well, first of all the money that government spends ultimately will come from the citizens of the country. One of the great fallacies that some people have is the idea that there is taxes and then there's something else. Debt, for instance, is just deferred taxes. It just means you will pay plus interest later, but you will still pay. So I think, back to my original point at the start about helping the country rather than hurting the country, we have long said that this and other items should be paid for through a transparent revenue source so that people know that they're paying for it and that we're not deluding people by making them think the money is coming from somewhere else. No, it's coming from you. And you need to know that it's coming from you. Even when the government borrows and makes it look like it's coming from somewhere else, no, it's coming from you. It's just that when it borrows, you'll pay back with interest. So that's been our position for some time. Look, the Social Relief of Distress Grant is actually a COVID grant. It was introduced as a 6-month support during the lockdown. But decisions have been made to extend it, and so that's where we are. But from our side, what we've said that ideally what you want is you want to be transparent with people, and the government needs to be transparent with people and say that this is where the money is coming from and that you are paying for it. And so that's been our position. And that's been our position internally within the government. And of course, the policymakers must decide what the different options are. We've laid options on the table, and we hope that that issue gets resolved.
It is. It's ultimately, do we spend on that or do we spend on this? It's the same pool of money. It's just how it's going to get sliced and diced. But I want to pick up the point about money just doesn't come from anywhere else except taxes, because actually this year, money did come from somewhere else. The $150 billion from the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account. DEFECRA is now the acronym of the week. Everyone's now learned this new acronym. There is this $150 billion that you're going to take from these reserves and use to not settle debt, but to as part of the debt. Instead of having to borrow more, you will use these funds over the next 3 years. Maybe just give a brief explanation to our listeners as how that's working, and maybe put people's minds at ease that this isn't a new money pot that people are going to say, well, why don't we, if you want to extend the grant, just go and plug into DEFECRA next time as well?
Yeah. So absolutely, it's not some money pot. It's, you know, the word we use is it's a valuation benefit. So you can have, you know, you people understand valuation benefits in different contexts, perhaps not in this kind of context because it's a different kind of thing. But, you know, those of us that, you know, either own assets or things of this nature, we understand how a valuation, the value of something can improve, but that doesn't mean that you suddenly have a pot of money. It just means that things' value has gone up. And so the question becomes, well, how do you realize that valuation improvement? How does it actually become money? And that's where the idea that it's not a pot of money becomes very, very important to understand, because, of course, it isn't. Essentially, DEFECRA, it's an account held at the South African Reserve Bank that basically is there for the foreign exchange transactions that the country engages in continuously. And of course, one of the big determinants of that, of how much is in that account, is the value of the rand against other major currencies. As everybody knows, the value of the rand has declined somewhat over the last number of years, which is not a good thing because, of course, that's had an impact on, for example, inflation for the ordinary person in the country. One thing that it has done is that it has increased the valuation amounts that are in DEFECRA. And it's a paper amount. It's a paper profit, of course. But it then raises the question, well, that valuation has grown to such a level. At the end of March, it reached over about 507 billion rands in a valuation benefit in that particular account. So we've decided to basically utilize a portion of that. But what it does mean is that the government and the Reserve Bank in particular has got to go out and it's basically got to produce money from those valuation benefits. And so the way that it's going to do that is it's going to increase the size of its deposits with commercial banks, but that's going to cost money to do that. And so to avoid a situation where the interest costs on that go out of control, the bank has to have additional money. So the way it's going to work is like this, and we're calling it three buckets. There's going to be three buckets to DEFECRA. The first bucket is having a sufficient buffer in place within the account so that if and when the rand appreciates in value, you then don't end up with a situation where the account is totally depleted and then you have to pay into the account as a result of that. Because the idea is when the rand goes down, the valuation benefit goes up. When the rand goes up, the valuation benefit goes down. So we've left a buffer there of about 250 billion. Then the rest of the 250 billion, we then say, okay, we are going to utilize that, but 100 billion of that 200 billion has got to be given back to the bank so that it pays the cost of liquidating its position in order to be able to make available 150 billion to government. So that you can tell this is all very, very complicated, But the bottom line is that in the end, 150 billion becomes available to the government. And all of that 150 billion is being used to reduce government borrowings. So we're not spending any of it. We're just reducing government borrowings. And it's helping us reduce not only the borrowings, but also the interest on borrowing. So debt service costs can then come down and be quite a bit lower as a result of doing that. So that is,
the accounting part of it is very challenging. My husband's an accountant, right, and he understood it and tried to explain it to me, and I still didn't really understand it. But what I can probably simplify it for listeners is to say, you have a property, your property goes up in value, you can go to the bank and actually borrow against that increase in the value of your property. And that's kind of a little bit what's happening here. You haven't actually sold the house, but you're able to borrow against that higher valuation. But of course, you've got to be careful that you're not borrowing so much in case property prices go down and all the rest of it. So I think it's probably a simpler way of it. But
that's one analogy. Of course, the problem with that analogy is that a rand depreciation is not the same as a house's value improving. But you're absolutely right. Understanding valuation benefits is the key.
Yeah, that's the key. So I just wanted to, I put this out on social media when I read it, and I have had so many questions about it that I realized I need to ask you this. On the 1st of April, 2024, the Corporation for Deposit Insurance comes into effect. So this basically will guarantee deposits to the value of 100,000 rand in the case of a bank failure, thinking African Bank, VBS. Now, from what I understood, the Reserve Bank has kind of already undertaken that, but there was never a fund specifically for it. So what is this fund? How is it going to work? Everyone seems freaked out. They all think suddenly we're worried about our banks that we need this. But as far as I'm aware, it's just prudence. Countries around the world do it all the time.
Yeah, exactly right. So this is international standard. It's quite common in a number of countries around the world. The United States has, for instance, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. You know, it's an emerging over the last decade and a half since the financial crisis, an important part of financial sector and in particular banking reform. So no, it's not it's got nothing to do with fears about deposits or the banking sector. In fact, South Africa's banking sector is renowned for being very sound and for being very well managed and for having very good levels of capital adequacy. So this is about protecting depositors. This is about ensuring that we have a resolution framework for banks that puts the depositors first whenever there's any issue. That's all that is.
Okay. And my last question to you, because this is my pet thing is tax-free savings accounts. I love tax-free savings accounts. And it's been years since you've increased the limit of 36,000 Rand a year or the lifetime limit. Are we going to be able to ever see this increase? Or is this just like at the back of your list of many things that you're trying to deal with at the moment?
Well, I'm afraid you're going to have to wait for an answer on that one, because you know, there's a lot of discussion around this, and it is part, I'm afraid, of a list of things on the taxation side that are currently under discussion. We think that we've always been quite, I think, helpful and positive in encouraging savings. And in that regard, both for long-term savings, particularly on pensions and other things, it's a very important part of policy to incentivize medium to long-term savings. And in that regard, you know, the TFSAs remain important. But of course, we've got to balance that out with the fact that, unfortunately, we do find ourselves having to think about other ways of providing for capital investments of the state. That the state needs to undertake. And of course, at the same time, making sure that the distributional impact of the policy is correct. So my answer to you there, watch the space.
Okay, great. Well, I'll be watching it very carefully. It's one of my favorite tools to get people to start saving and investing. So I'll definitely be watching. But I want to say thank you so much. You've given me a lot of your time. I know it's been a hectic day today for you, I'm sure. But I appreciate it. And thank you for sharing your insights with the South African audience. So thank you very much.